Thank you. And thank you to the organizers of this workshop and to the KITP who made my presence here possible. This is a work that we have done in Saclay at the CEA, Commissariat à l'énergie atomique, about, say, experiments on spin glasses. So I shall try to be introductory, at least at the beginning. So I'll tell you some basic things about spin glasses, and I'm sorry for all the specialists who are here. Then the first part of my talk will be about aging phenomena and one special kind of rejuvenation which is very well known in material science. Then the second part will be devoted to rejuvenation as a function of temperature variation, so-called rejuvenation and memory effects, which is something slightly different, I think. And then I'll discuss what we can see in different real spin glass samples, which range from the easing case to more isotropic situations. And if I have enough time, I shall try to discuss this question of can we define length scales characteristic of the aging processes in these spin glasses. So let me just remind you, for those of you who are not familiar with spin glasses, that for a theoretician, a spin glass is a set of magnetic moments which are randomly interacting. So this distribution of Jij's is Gaussian, or plus or minus J, but those are random variables with random sign. And real spin glasses are slightly different, since they are obtained by a random dilution of the magnetic ions. And there are two main ways to obtain such a situation. The most ancient one was using metallic alloys. For instance, you take a matrix of a non-magnetic metal and then you throw by random a few percent of magnetic ions, like manganese. These magnetic ions are at random distances from each other, and due to the oscillating character of the RKKY magnetic interaction, they will be in a random sign interaction with each other. Another class of spin glasses has been found in insulating system. For instance, this compound has been very much studied in Saclay. Here you can see that the magnetic chromium is diluted by 15% of indium. If you forget about dilution, you get a ferromagnet with a TC of about 80 Kelvin. The nearest neighbor interactions are ferromagnetic, the next nearest ones are antiferromagnetic, and if you suppress some of the chromium ions, then you favor these antiferromagnetic interactions, and you push the balance towards a spin glass phase, and you lose the ferromagnetic properties. What is important is that the properties that I shall show you are essentially the same in all these systems. Finally, we obtained as a result that the details of the chemical realization of the spin glass don't really matter for such a generic behavior which is found in all samples, which is a glass temperature which we believe to be critical in three dimensions, and which will be my main focus, slow dynamics and aging phenomena. Yes?
The values of the critical exponents among these two big classes of spin glasses, anyone can say something about this?
They are completely spread out, and well, I'll come back to this later. Another question concerns magnetic systems in which there is frustration due to the topology of the lattice, like antiferromagnetic interactions on a Kagome lattice, for instance, without any disorder. Is there spin glass phase in such systems? Well, I think I shall not have time to discuss this today, but anybody is interested, I can show you the results.
Is there a Barkhausen noise measurement?
Barkhausen noise. You mean noise of ferromagnetic walls. Those are not ferromagnets. They are slightly away from the ferromagnetic phase. So I don't know about ferromagnetic domains or walls in it. Okay, so that's also something very introductory. What you can see of spin glass in the simplest possible experiment. This is just a measurement of magnetization as a function of temperature. And above this TG glass temperature, the behavior is paramagnetic, something like 1 over T. Now, if you go down in temperature, the spin glass phase appears with some magnetic irreversibilities. If you cool the system with a small field, then you get this field-cooled magnetization, which more or less flat, like it presents a plateau. On the other hand, if you cool the spin glass in zero field, then first it has zero magnetization. Well, this is just my residual field, which gives this slightly non-zero value. And then when you apply a field, the spin glass would like to get magnetized, but it cannot because it is in the frozen phase. So you obtain a very small magnetization at this point, the zero field cooled magnetization. This is out of equilibrium. If you wait at this point, it will slowly relax upwards. Now, if you don't want to wait and you just increase step by step the temperature, you draw this zero field cooled curve, which will merge with the field cooled one in the region of TG. If you want to study relaxation measurements, which I am used to do, you can either look at this point and look at the upwards relaxation, or go here, field cooling, and then cut the field and record the relaxation of this remnant magnetization. It has been shown that if we are using very weak magnetic fields, which is usually the case, the zero field cooled relaxation and the relaxation of this thermoremanent magnetization that you obtained by cutting the field in the field cooled phase, the sum of this plus this gives the value of the field cooled magnetization, which may in some cases slightly depend on time. This is work done by my colleagues from Uppsala. You had maybe a seminar by Per Nordblad some weeks ago. So now let's get more into the subject, and let me tell you how I can see aging phenomena in a spin glass. There are several different experimental procedures that can be used. The first one I just explained before, so cooling the spin glass in the presence of a small field. So there is some T equals zero to my clock when I'm cooling the spin glass and when I get to this temperature, which may be 0.7 TG, say. And then after some time TW, I cut the field and record the relaxation of the magnetization. This is what is plotted here as a function of time. So here, time equals zero at the time of the field cutoff. That's my usual notation. So this relaxation is slow. You can see that this is a logarithmic time scale. That's already the signature of a glassy state. But the second feature of these curves is that they depend on the time TW you have been waiting after cooling down the spin glass and before cutting the field and triggering the magnetic response. For short TW, the curve can be like this, and after a longer TW, it can be like this one, which means the initial fall-off of the magnetization is smaller, and this slow relaxation is still slower than I would have had with a shorter TW. So the spin glass has been getting stiffer and stiffer with time, and its magnetic response is slower and slower as I increase this TW. These curves present an inflection point which is more or less located at T equals TW. And if you plot them as a function of T over TW, as a first approximation, you almost put all the curves together. I'll come back to this in more details. But in the first approximation, you can remember that there is a rough T over TW scaling of these curves. Now I can make an equivalent experiment, but in the harmonic regime, by applying a small oscillating field. The temperature procedure is the same. I start from the paramagnetic phase, and then, getting to this temperature, I measure the susceptibility. This susceptibility at a given frequency depends on the time since I cooled the spin glass. You can see this relaxation. So now here I have again two time scales, say omega, the frequency of the AC field, and the time of aging or waiting time. And here I also have this TW and the time from the field cutoff. So the important point is that we now have two time scales and that there is no time translational invariance in this case. This is what we call aging, or in other words, non-stationary dynamics. Yes?
You can check the linearity of the AC susceptibility?
Yes, you mean as a function of the field amplitude?
Yes.
Yes. All this should be at very small field amplitudes in such a way that the response is proportional to the field. Yes, otherwise I shall make it clear. In other experiments, we shall check what is the effect of a higher magnetic field.
Sorry,
yes.
Ah,
okay, so here, that's the out-of-phase part of the susceptibility, chi double prime. And I chose to show it because in relative value, this relaxation is higher than for the in-phase component. So it's more visible, but I can see the relaxation in chi prime. Yes, yes. Okay, now that was for the double prime. And for the minus chi double prime zero, it's because these curves are going to some asymptotic value, which is the equilibrium value at the given frequency. And here, those measurements have been taken at different frequencies. And the asymptotic value is different. So in order to have all the curves on the graph, I have shifted them by some arbitrary value. But if I take for this arbitrary value the equilibrium limit, then I shall be able to superpose these curves as a function of a reduced variable, which is the frequency times this waiting time in the laboratory. This omega TW variable is equivalent to T over TW for this DC procedure. So, of course, there is some stationary dynamics which must be subtracted before being able to show scaling of this. Well, a qualitative feature of these curves is that at lower frequency, like here, the relaxation in a given time window has a stronger amplitude than at higher frequencies. So if you look at a spin glass at much higher frequencies, you will not see aging. Aging is visible when the inverse frequency is of the same order of magnitude as the time in the laboratory. Is this all right? That's okay? Yeah. So there is a third way to access to these aging properties of spin glasses, which I want to mention, but I shall not develop here because this is not my work, but it's in the same group. But this is the work of Miguel Ossio and Didier Hérisson, and I don't want to enter into details in this, but I want to say that they have been able to measure the spontaneous magnetic fluctuations of the spin glass in the absence of any magnetic field. So this is what is pictured here. You can see examples of noise signal as a function of time. So this is magnetization as a function of time, starting here after cooling the spin glass from the paramagnetic phase. And this is rather difficult to record because you have to get rid of all other sources of noise. But they could make it. And now when you have this kind of traces, you can take any couple of points, which we can call TW and T on this trace, and compute the correlation function between the magnetization at time TW and the magnetization at time T. And then you can plot these correlation functions at fixed TW as a function of T, and you obtain a set of curves which look the same as the relaxation curves, which are again shown here, relaxation after cutting a small field. But of course, most of you know that the relation between this and this is highly non-trivial. For equilibrium situations, this is the fluctuation dissipation theorem. But here, we are in this aging regime of non-equilibrium. So the relation between both quantities is something mysterious. There has been these very nice theoretical predictions by Cogliandolo, Courchan, and others about how this relation should be modified. And these experiments have allowed to check how fluctuation-dissipation relations hold in the aging regime. But, okay, I have the data about this, but I shall not focus my seminar on this. So that's a scaling plot of the relaxation curves, and instead of using this rough T over TW, there is a good scaling variable here. I'll say a few words about it. And so these insets show that the correlation and the relaxation functions obey the same scaling law. How many times?
What's TW?
Yes, in this experiment, no field is cut, there is no field, so you just take TW where you like on this trace, and you compute the correlation of one point with the other. The noise signals are recorded as a function of time, and you can just do what you want afterwards. Okay? Well, you should invite Miguel Ossio to tell you about all this. Now, let me take an example of glassy dynamics in something completely different, which is non-magnetic. So, sorry for using my transparencies in French. This vieillissement means aging. And this is an example taken from a paper by Leheny and Nagel about glycerol, which is a real structural glass. And they have shown that the measurement of the dielectric constant shows, as a function of time after quenching this glycerol, a relaxation which looks rather similar to that obtained in spin glasses. Here there are measurements at different frequencies. You can see that the same trend seems to take place as in spin glasses. Lower frequency, bigger amplitude of relaxation. Well, however, the authors say this does not obey an omega t scaling exactly, but well, maybe we should discuss this. So that's an example of something which happens in the same way as in spin glasses in a structural glass. And other very famous and old examples can be found in the book of Struik about the glassy behavior of amorphous polymers, or I don't remember the title exactly. The procedure is almost the same as in the spin glass, except that here this is a mechanical response that is measured. So they cool the polymer from above to below Tg, they wait some time, and then apply a stress and record the slow train of, here this is a PVC. And this gives such curves. For a short aging time, they get a rather fast curve, while for longer and longer waiting times, they get slower and slower curves. You can see here that the time is counted in days. This is 300 days. This is 1,000 days. Of course, this is not far from room temperature. In the spin glass, we could not keep 10 Kelvin during 1 year. That would have been expensive. But the scaling laws, which allow to superpose all these curves, are the same, exactly the same here as in the magnetic disordered system, as in the spin glass. And until now, I want to emphasize the fact that these aging properties at fixed temperature look exactly the same, well, almost exactly the same in different glassy systems. That's a point. And there is another aspect which I would like to emphasize, is that rejuvenation is something which is rather well known in material studies. For instance, this volume relaxation of an epoxy glass from this paper as a function of time on a log scale. The line here shows aging. This is just the volume relaxation. Well, not that in the spin glass we don't have access to a quantity which would be equivalent to this volume until now. But we are dealing with response functions usually. But, well, here we see the relaxation of the volume. And what they show is that if after some time of aging they apply a stress on the sample, this is probably here a shear stress, then suddenly the volume jumps up and the relaxation restarts. So this is like aging restarting more or less from the beginning. So that's why this is called rejuvenation, and this is rejuvenation under the action of stress, of a mechanical stress. And this can be repeated several times, and I think it's rather well known. I think that the equivalent of this in spin glasses is rejuvenation under the effect of a field variation. And I show this again on a chi double prime plot. So the AC field which is applied to obtain this response is a very small field, say 0.1 Gauss or 1 Gauss maybe. And I can record this relaxation after cooling the spin glass. But now if I apply a field which is 30 Gauss, clearly stronger than the small field which is used for the measurement, then I can see a restart of this relaxation of chi double prime. And this is a rejuvenation effect which, in my opinion, is comparable to that one. This is a strong perturbation which is brought to the system by applying this magnetic field. The spin glass is drawn towards magnetized states, which are very different from the non-magnetized states, and all this equilibration process has to restart. And conversely, if I now cut this field after some time, the relaxation will start again. Yes. The noise here? That's because in the presence of the field, I have a relaxing total magnetization, which is now putting noise in my AC measurement. Of course, with this lock-in detection, I only take the response at my given frequency, but I still have this strong magnetization. If the sample is slightly vibrating in the coils, I get much more noise. It's not a ferromagnet.
Yeah, you can still define distribution of these jumps of the magnetization, of the statistics.
Oh, the jumps here?
Yes.
I think they are just experimental noise. You see, because this, we have a DC relaxation which is relaxing because I apply the field in the frozen phase. So I think this is not significant.
But maybe that was smaller samples where you can see some non-trivial avalanches.
No. You mean individual jumps of magnetization, which would mean flipping of some. No. And no. Yes. Yes.
If you were to apply that rather than after 300 minutes, sooner than that, say after 100 minutes, would the jump amplitude be smaller?
I should know the answer to this question. I'm not sure I can give it now. But we have made experiments with different TWs here. Okay, I'll think about it and tell you later.
So, when you apply this field, keep it there, right? So
yes.
So you have a magnetization.
Yes.
Constant.
It's not constant. It's relaxing because.
Not constant, but it will not be zero.
Yes, non-zero. Yes. Yes. So it's putting some noise on the measurement, despite the fact that I'm taking the data at a fixed frequency. Because, I don't know, even mechanical vibrations of the sample in the pickup coil can give some contribution at this frequency. This frequency is 0.1 hertz, so it's not far from the mechanics, of course. Okay? So that's rejuvenation by a stress in a structural glass or by a magnetic field in a spin glass. We can go one step farther about this effect of a non-negligible field. This view graph shows how you can get a very good scaling of the curves at different waiting times by considering that this is not just exactly T over TW. I think I shall not explain this in detail now, but you should just consider that the characteristic response times in the spin glass are varying not exactly like TW or TW plus the time elapsed since the beginning of the relaxation, but as TW plus T to some power mu, which is a number slightly smaller than one. This is observed in all spin glasses, and the question of where it's coming from is not yet solved, actually. We call this sub-aging, and in that case, the good scaling variable is, let's approximate this by T over TW to the mu. That will be simpler for now. And if mu equals 1, this is T over TW. And if mu goes to 0, there is no influence of TW, which means no aging. And what I want to show you here is that if I make magnetization relaxation measurements for higher and higher amplitudes of the field, then I'm progressively killing that aging which occurred during TW before I start the measurement. And this is equivalent to this rejuvenation by a stress that I showed in the previous transparency. Here I have plotted this exponent mu as a function of the amplitude of the field. Okay, you can just look at blue or red points as you like. So you see that here I have a small plateau between 10 Gauss and some very, very small value here, where mu remains lower than 1. Note that from the very sensitive measurements of Osio, who measured the noise and the response in the same setup, he took the response with very small fields, which were 1 milligauss, about 1 milligauss. So this plateau is not so small, actually. It's extending, you should see it on a log scale, it's extending from 1 milligauss to, say, 10 gauss. So clearly, when we put the field to 0, this mu does not seem to want to go to 1. That's one point. But on the other side, if I increase the field, I clearly see that mu is decreasing. And finally, if I use a 300 Hochstedt, same as Gauss, 300 Gauss field to measure the relaxation of the magnetization, I still have a slow relaxation, but it does not still depend on TW, because mu has gone to 0, and this is erasing of aging by the field variation, same kind of rejuvenation as I have shown in the previous transparency. That's another example in not exactly structural glass, but paste, colloidal paste. It's even toothpaste in that case. You know that emulsions, foams, colloidal pastes, they behave like elastic solids at low stresses, but they can flow like a liquid, a viscous liquid, but a liquid, above some yield stress. And this is exactly what you expect from your toothpaste, actually. So that when you press the tube, you want the paste to flow onto the toothbrush, but once it's on the toothbrush, you prefer that it does not continue to flow down to the floor. So that's why people work on this problem at Ofina, for instance, and that's maybe why this can be published in Physical Review Letters as well. those systems are very interesting because once more they show the same aging behavior as I can see in the spin glass, but there is not clearly a temperature in that problem. So in this experiment, the starting point is a strong stress applied to the paste. That's the TW equals zero. And then this paste becomes a viscous liquid. And then they wait during a given TW and apply another stress, much smaller, and record how it's responding. And those are the relaxation curves for different TWs. You see, it looks like any other glass. And the authors have made a plot with about the same scaling variable as in the spin glass, so they could superpose the curves. And this inset is the value of the sub-aging exponent mu, same as in the spin glass, which is shown to decrease with the amplitude of the stress that is applied to the paste. Yes? I guess it will saturate. Certainly it will saturate, but if anybody else knows the answer, no, I guess it will saturate. Yes.
The value at stress equal to zero, the value mu is equal to one.
Yes. yes, that's it. Okay, I don't know if it's a matter of data accuracy or I don't know. In polymers, if you take the book of Strick, for instance, you find very different values of mu in different materials. Strick have been studying all possible polymers, including cheese, bitume, these kind of things, and well, he found very different values of mu. It's not very common that mu goes to one. So I don't know if it's general in this paste. No. Yes. Yes, it's found different from sample to sample, actually. Yes, yes. And there are several explanations, possible explanations. I think that the effect of the magnetic field itself can be ruled out as an explanation. Because, okay, it's the effect of the field is to decrease mu. But when you go to vanishing field, mu, in that case, does not want to go to 1. Could be a finite size effect, could be the effect of the beginning of the cooling procedure. We don't know exactly for now. Yes. Yes, 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 there is no particular trend. No, we did not notice anything. Okay, well, I'm not going very fast, but it's supposed to be somewhat informal, so. Well, anyway, at some time, I'll check the time. okay, let's go now to rejuvenation and memory as a function of temperature. In a way, all these explanations about rejuvenation as a function of magnetic field compared to the effect of a stress in a material was to point out that as a function of temperature, maybe we can get to some other phenomena. And I want to emphasize the difference in that case. So for these temperature experiments, the picture that we had in mind at the beginning was this kind of picture that everybody has in mind concerning glasses. That is a relaxation of some thermodynamical quantity like enthalpy or specific volume with an equilibrium curve as a function of temperature. And when cooling the glass, at some temperature, one falls out of equilibrium following this kind of branch. Or if cooling more slowly, then sticking to the equilibrium value down to lower temperatures, but finally falling out of equilibrium anyway. So the important point here is that if I cool more slowly, then I can stick to the equilibrium value in a larger temperature region. So we wanted to know whether in spin glasses we were able to remain closer to equilibrium by cooling more slowly, and things happened to behave quite differently. For instance, this can be pictured in this very simple experiment, in which I compare the effect of a rather fast cooling through TG, which is say here, and fast and slower cooling, except in the very last part here. So the difference is that I spent much more time here in the region of TG than in that case. And after this, reaching this point, I record the relaxation of the AC susceptibility, which is plotted here, blue and red, and you can see that there is no difference between the two measurements. Which means that spending a lot of time in the region of TG did not help the spin glass to get closer to equilibrium. So that seems to point out an important difference with structural glasses. And we have developed numerous experimental procedures to study this kind of things. This is almost a historical experiment now from 92. It's just a measurement of chi double prime as a function of time. And after some aging at a given temperature, like here, we go down in temperature by some temperature interval delta T, which is here going from 12 Kelvin to 10 Kelvin. TG is 16.7. And you can see that indeed this long relaxation at 12 Kelvin did not really help, because when now I go to 10, the dissipation increases and the relaxation starts again. This relaxation is almost similar to the one I could obtain by cooling directly the spin glass to this temperature. So this means waiting a long time here did not help to have here properties which are closer to equilibrium. So this is what I would call rejuvenation as a function of a temperature decrease in the case of the spin glass. And now the second interesting point is that when I get back to the previous temperature, things will not go like in the case of the magnetic field, but in this case, for a 2 Kelvin temperature interval, the susceptibility gets back to its previous value, and the relaxation continues exactly in continuation with that one. This is a memory effect of the state reached before making this negative temperature cycle. This is memory effect. You can see that the two parts of the curve can be put in continuation of each other. So we have here rejuvenation when the temperature is decreased and memory when the temperature is increased back. So this is rather different to what I obtained with a field cycle.
How do you understand this rejuvenation?
Okay, that will be the scope of all the seminar, I think. let me just go progressively to it. But for now, another experimental procedure. Yes, please. If I increase the temperature, that's what is. If I increase the temperature, I get here. You mean if I increase farther, then when I go back, I shall restart relaxation, even without going above TG. It's enough of a small temperature interval to obtain rejuvenation and memory. Or maybe your question is, what about this memory? It's as if I increase the temperature, the memory is erased. I just forget what happened at lower temperatures. And indeed, here I have memory of this, but I forgot what happened here. That's it. So another experimental, this experimental procedure, more spectacular, in which we tried to show several memories as a function of temperature. This is chi double prime as a function of temperature. In blue, the cooling procedure, we started from the paramagnetic phase. Here, chi double prime is equal to zero. Then we get to into the spin glass phase. You see dissipation suddenly increases. And at this temperature, we stabilize the temperature and wait for the relaxation. And you see that this relaxation is just showing aging. So we have been cooling the sample step by step like this, maybe half an hour at each step. So after this long relaxation, then we cool one more step down, and we see this rejuvenation, susceptibility increases, and the relaxation restarts. This is some new aging starting, apparently. And we can do this several times. And at each time, it seems that the relaxation is not influenced by previous waiting times. It's almost new. However, if I now heat the sample back continuously along these red points, I can see that at each of the temperatures where there was a waiting time, there is a dip in the susceptibility, which is the memory of the former aging. You see that the spin glass is able to remember one memory, another memory, another memory. In some sense, some information has been stored in the spin glass at each of the temperatures where we waited enough to make aging. This kind of picture is not an explanation, but a first description of these effects. We thought of the three energy surface like people often do in glasses, with some minima and some free energy barriers which must be crossed. And aging is, at a given temperature, is simply going and visiting these metastable states more and more in order to approach an equilibrium population rate in the various metastable states. So the idea is that when we have rejuvenation, when going down in temperature, this energy landscape is changed, and there are new details that appear and that are revealed by temperature, but maybe these barriers are growing from one temperature to the other. And there is a new landscape in which new aging can take place, and this is this causes the renewed dissipation when going down in temperature. The advantage of this hierarchical picture is that it can provide memory when I get back to the previous temperature, because now I can consider that these substates are merging into their parent state. And so the evolution which occurred within this one, and this one, does not influence the equilibrium, does not influence the population rates at this temperature, which are the same as before going down in temperature. And this provides me with a memory effect. So that's a picture by hand. Of course, it refers to some random energy models like Derrida has developed. And of course, it refers also to the trap model of Bouchot and David Dean. Recently, Munetaka Sasaki has made some calculations about these random energy models, and he has shown that many details of the experiments can indeed be reproduced in such a picture. So that's a
system with like temperature chaos or more droplet?
It's there is no temperature chaos in this
picture.
That's an interesting question, of course. That's an interesting question. Well, if I look at this picture, it's not clear that I need chaos to produce this.
Just understand the picture.
Yes. I think the temperature chaos does not appear to be necessary at this stage. It's Well, I'll come back to this, if you allow me, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit later, yes. Okay, so now that you think that everything is simple, in structural glasses we have strong cooling rate effects, in spin glasses we don't have cooling rate effects, but rejuvenation and memory, let me confuse you a little bit. Are not there any cooling rate effects at all in the spin glass? That's not true. And for instance, I can show memory and cooling rate effects in this kind of procedure, which was proposed by Nordblad and the Uppsala group. So that consists in measuring zero field cooled magnetization, cooled in zero field, and then apply the field at low temperature and increase temperature. And during the cooling, one can stop at some temperatures and wait in zero field and see how this influences the final curve as a function of temperature. So the simplest measurement is the red curve, fast cooling with no stop at all. And a measurement which shows nicely the rejuvenation and memory effect is these red circles. I have been waiting some time at this temperature and this temperature. And now, coming up in temperature, red circles, here it's the same as the other curve, but now approaching the temperature of aging, there is a dip, and here there is another dip, well separated from the previous one, and then, okay, it's the same. So now, what would be the cooling rate effect compared to this? I have taken data with a slow cooling, and no waiting time stop, slow cooling by a factor 60. And this is the blue curve. You can see that the blue curve is indeed different from the red curve obtained by fast cooling. So there is a cooling rate effect, but what the spin glass shows to us is an ability to memorize some information of concerning aging at a given temperature and at another. And of course we can try to see how this can mix together, memory effects and cooling rate effects. Those are the green circles. So this is a slow cooling with two stops in addition, and then you get the green circles. They are close to the blue curve. But on top of this cooling rate effect, you can see that there is a temperature-specific effect which appears here and here. So instead of opposing structural glasses and spin glasses in a too simplistic way, I would like to say that there are cooling rate effects in both systems. I would call this accumulation of aging as a function of temperature, and the spin glass is able to show rejuvenation and memory effects, which are temperature-specific processes. So now, of course, the question is, what about the structural glasses? Are they able to show something else than cooling rate effects? There are not many experiments. Yeah. I did not try to show a cooling rate effect because everything was taken at the same speed. But I think I could have shown something like this using very different cooling rates.
So maybe the ones that you showed were you measured 5 seconds after cooling slowly or cooling fast?
Ah, yes. In
there you didn't see it. The one
which red. Yes, that's right. That's probably because of this, because at the end of, I guess so. Oh yes, but if I do it down to here at the same slow speed, then clearly in the last temperature interval, I shall accumulate some aging which will contribute to the temperature. So the result then is different, but you can't really conclude. No, there can be cooling rate effects, but you see that the memory effect is still very much, very well temperature defined in the spin glass. And well, let's take a piece of PMMA from my colleague Sergio Siliberto, who was here a few weeks ago. I don't know if he talked about this, but I like these experiments. So those are measurements of the dielectric susceptibility of PMMA. Here as a function of temperature, so there is some hysteresis between cooling and heating, and they can see some aging, which is a relaxation of this dielectric susceptibility. So now they have tried to compare the effect of aging at different temperatures. This is what is shown here in terms of this. This is the difference between the measurement without a stop for aging and with a stop for aging. So if you don't, so, and that's the cooling, that's the heating. So let's look at cooling. So up to, down to the stop, there is zero difference with and without a stop. And at some temperature, the weight and the dielectric susceptibility is relaxing. And then when they go to lower temperatures, it's going slightly up. Now they can do this experiment with different aging temperatures. Like the green one, they stop here, let the relaxation, let the dielectric susceptibility relax, and then like this. And also in the red case. So now what can we see when we increase back the temperature? That's what is shown here. For the black case, there is a kind of very wide, deep, which is centered at a temperature which is not far from here. And what is very clear in this result is that in the green and red case, these dips are centered at a different temperature, one from each other. So, of course, this is spread out over the temperature interval of the measurement, which is not so large relatively to the absolute temperature. But I think it clearly shows that some that aging here, here, and here had something like is somewhat temperature specific, because I can see a memory which depends on the temperature of aging. So that would tend to prove that glasses don't only have cooling rate effects, but they can show rejuvenation and memory effects as well. Other experiments are needed, I think. There are not many results concerning this kind of phenomena in glasses. Polymethyl methacrylate. it's some piece of plastic, usual plastic. Okay. Well, let me now turn back to the spin glasses. Now that we have seen that the memory effects are very sharp in the spin glass and much spread out in this piece of PMMA, is it always so sharp in the spin glasses? And we found that no, things are not so simple. We have been turning to an easing example. Well, those are not really theoretician easing spins, but this is a sample with a very strong anisotropy along a given axis, and that may be considered as an example of a system of easing spins. This sample is very well known. It's from our Japanese colleagues. So we have performed this rejuvenation and memory procedure on this sample, so you see cooling, aging, rejuvenation, then aging, then rejuvenation, and coming back along the yellow points, some memory here and some memory here. And well, I wanted to show this example because if you keep in mind what I have shown for the other spin glass, really it's much more spread out in temperature in that system. So I should not say that sharp memory effects are specific to spin glasses as opposed to structural glasses, since in that case I can find it more spread out in temperature. So we wanted to understand what happens in these generalization of this problem, what happens in other spin glasses. And we took a series of samples of different anisotropies that have been studied in Orsay by Jan Campbell and Dorothée Petit, and we made some systematic comparisons of the sharpness of the memory effect. So let me show you two examples. This first spin glass is not exactly Heisenberg, but it's rather isotropic. And this is the easing sample. And I have taken relaxation data with this temperature cycling procedure during the waiting time, which means that during most of the waiting time, we cool down from T to T minus dT. And then we come back, cut the field, and see how the relaxation curve looks like. For instance, if I make dt equal zero, this is just a 10,000 seconds waiting time at constant temperature, and I get this black bold curve here. That's a reference. Now I could also take the other limit and make a very large delta T, going to zero Kelvin, say, which would mean that I only have this time of 500 plus this time of 500 for aging at the temperature T. And I know what is the curve that I obtain, which is a 1,000 seconds old curve. That's the other reference, again, black bold here. Now, if I apply different values of this temperature interval during the waiting time, I can see how much is the influence of aging at T minus delta T onto the aging state at T. And you understand that in the case of full memory, for instance, this means that there is no influence at all of this on aging at temperature T. So, and okay, memory is possible as soon as aging at different temperatures are going on well independently from each other. So this is exactly what we check here. And you can see in this typical spin glass example that for a relatively small temperature interval, which is 0.5 Kelvin at 12 Kelvin. Tg is 17 Kelvin. So this is 0.03 Tg interval. I get these big red circles here, which are almost on the 1,000 seconds curve, which means that aging here at 0.5 Kelvin below almost did not bring any influence to aging at 12 Kelvin. So that's exactly what is able to cause this sharp memory effect in this kind of spin glass. Aging at the lower temperature had almost no influence on aging at the higher temperature. So this curve for a small temperature interval is going down almost to the reference curve. Now if I compare this with the easing case, in which you remember the memory dips were more spread out in temperatures, you see that a comparable temperature interval of the same fraction of Tg yields again the red points, which are this time not so close to the 1,000 curve, to the 1,000 seconds curve. Which means that in that case, aging at a lower temperature had much more influence than it had in that case. Yes?
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was at that point. But if I look at the blue curve, the dt of 0.2 k on the upper plot.
Yes.
That looks similar and is halfway between.
Yes.
So when you say there's a very large difference, there's a factor of 2 in the relative.
Yes, yes, yes. No, but that makes a difference. Yes, that makes a difference quantitatively, because you may consider that temperature enters through exponentials to give the response times, or the and changing. Well, I can show you how much it changes in the next view graph, because that's just the principle of the experiment, and we have taken a lot of data like this with different temperature intervals and different samples. And we have looked precisely at how this, how the contribution of aging at the lower temperature, which is some effective aging time, how this varies with the temperature interval. So this is what I show here for 0.7 TGs. So there are a lot of experiments behind these data points. So again, we compare here the effect of a given T2 at the lower temperature. In comparison, this effect is estimated from this effective waiting time at T, which gives the same relaxation curve. And I can plot the ratio T effective over T2 as a function of the temperature interval. And the results are here. As a reference, I put here this straight line, which corresponds to simple thermal activation, what I would expect from thermal slowing down, saying simply that the time needed to cross a given barrier is exponential of this barrier divided by kT, with some microscopic attempt time. Then if I vary T by dT, I know how much should be the effective time contribution. And I can draw this line, that's a straight line if I take a log scale here. You see that the different spin glasses that we have studied here are all below the straight line, which means that the effective times in this case are decreasing faster than you would expect when you decrease the temperature. That signs up the separation of aging at the different temperatures. And if I get a very steepy curve here, then I can get very sharp dips when looking at the sky double prime measurement as a function of temperature. So we noticed that the dips were spread out in the easing case and more and sharper in other cases. Now I can show you the results from five different samples from Campbell and Petit in Orsay. I can put numbers about an isotropy in this sample. Easing is easing, and in these samples there is a random anisotropy which is supposed to be of Jelosinski-Moria type. So it's induced by the freezing of the spins, and it gives random axes of an isotropy locally. So here I can put numbers in reference to this case, silver manganese, and here it's difficult to give a number. Well, nevertheless, I can label them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, starting from easing. And you see that the results are going like 1, 2, 4, 3, 5. Okay. And 3 and 4, I would say, are not so different. So there seems to be really a systematic of the sharpness of the memory effect as a function of the anisotropy of the spins in these systems. We have data at a second temperature, closer to TG, and the systematics is even better, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there is really something. So of course they ask the question about, do we have a different spin glass with easing or with Heisenberg spins? And as you know, it's not obvious to have spin glass phase in 3D with short-range interactions for Heisenberg spins. So that's maybe an open question. If you look at this recent paper, it said that you can find a finite TC even for Heisenberg spins. However, the idea that there may be some... The idea is that, yes, there can be some systematic variation of the nature of the characteristics of the spin glass phase as a function of anisotropy. This was already suggested by the results from our Orsay colleagues. So this is now answering to the question of critical exponents that somebody asked at the beginning. They studied the critical exponents of the transition in these different samples, and they found that there is a systematic variation of the exponents, ranging from what you expect for an Edwards Anderson spin glass, for corresponding to easing sample, ranging from this to exponents which are close to what is expected from chiral-related Riven mechanism, and these exponents apply well to the more isotropic case. So I would say that our results support this other approach of a systematic variation of the spin glass properties as a function of spin and isotropy, and this might support this scenario proposed by Kawamura for the transition, since in this scenario with zero anisotropy, well, there would be no transition because the chirality freezing would not be transmitted to the spins, but in real experiment I don't have zero anisotropy, and his scenario was that as soon as anisotropy is not zero, then the spins can feel that the chirality is freezing. And this could be the underlying mechanism for the spin glass transition for Heisenberg spins. So, well, I leave it to theoreticians to know whether this is now put in a bad position by these results, which maybe should be confirmed. Is there some contradiction with Nishimori's theorem? Well, I don't know about this. I just want to show you what we can see about this with the spin glass aging experiments.
So, can I just remind you of the 0.7 GG data on the previous?
Yeah.
And both, if you try to collapse the curves in delta t over t, can you do that? Can you scale? I mean, because there are large differences in tf over t2.
Yes.
So
there are.
A factor of 3 or 4 there.
Oh, yes. It's a log scale. It's rather important.
In delta t over t. But if you collapse, I can collapse the curves this way also.
Well, I can fit all these curves with a model that I shall show in a minute. But any ideas are welcome. That's significant. That's. Okay, so well, I think it's a bit late, but I can try to give you some general ideas about this point. I think that we have to think of length scales in the spin glass in order to be able to compare these different spin glasses. And of course, this now refers to the droplet model of Fisher, thinking of the spin glass as some kind of disguised ferromagnet in which after the quench, the starting configuration is completely random, but there are correlations which are progressively developing on larger and larger distances. I think this is a very general idea, and there is a typical length which we can try to identify in this problem. And it's not necessary that this length be the size of a compact droplet which would make the spin glass just a simple ferromagnet. But anyway, there may be a length, and to know what is this length may be another question. And in that picture, in order to have rejuvenation when lowering the temperature, one needs this idea of chaos, and because otherwise the domain growth would simply continue at just a slower rate at the lower temperature. And if this chaos does not destroy everything in the sample, then you can still have memory of a typical size of the domains. And an example of such a scenario is shown here. This is a work by Yoshino and Anaël Lemaître, who is here. So that's not a spin glass. This is a ferromagnet, or more precisely, a Matisse model. So for a given set of bonds, they let grow these domains that you can see here. And then in order to simulate the effect of a temperature change, they have changed the distribution of bonds, which makes the ferromagnetic equilibrium state to be different. And at that time, some new processes of domain growth start. And this is what is seen when we come back to the former gauge, as these small holes in the big domains. If you don't wait too long after this strong change of the bonds, there will be some new small domains inside the big domains, and yet you can have the memory of the former evolution. So I take this example because I think that the chaos scenario is well pictured by this kind of example. Now it's clear that in experiments we have multiple memories at different temperatures. So if we think of small domains into bigger domains, we have to think even of a hierarchy of domains into domains into domains, which are selected by temperature. And this is what Bouchot called temperature microscope effect, in the sense that one may think that a given temperature selects a given length scale in the sample. But the sample has to be complex enough to provide us with the possibility of different aging evolutions at different temperatures. And clearly, if we want to think of all these phenomena in terms of domain growth, we can ask the nature of these domains, since they are like a piece of cheese with many, many holes, and certainly cannot be compact. So can we go a little bit farther and evidence such a growing length scale in a spin glass during aging? I guess that most of you know that in simulations, yes, you can define a correlation function which shows a characteristic size after a given waiting time, and the result is roughly that it varies like a power law of the time with a small exponent, which is temperature dependent. On the other hand, on the experimental side, can we see a length? Well, I'll tell you how in a few words, and then does it show a difference between Ising and Heisenberg spin glasses? Those are new data that we have taken. So let me just recall how we think we can estimate a dynamical correlation length from experiments. We just make magnetization relaxation measurements. Starting from the zero field cooled state, we apply a small field and get a curve like this. This has been done in the Ising sample. Those are new data. And it has an inflection point, say, here. And now if I do the same experiment with a higher field, then I get a faster relaxation curve with an the low field is here. With waiting time here, and this one, of course, is faster with a higher field, and the effective waiting time, which can be the inflection point here, is shifted towards short times. And the idea is that this faster relaxation corresponds to a decrease, a reduction of the typical free energy barrier that can be crossed by the spin glass during aging, and that this reduction of the barrier is due to a Zeeman term, which is the coupling of the magnetic field to the spins in the sample. That's what is written here. So the experiment gives me TW effective as a result, and I take this data for different fields, and I can consider that the Zeeman energy is the coupling of the field to the magnetization of that typical number of spins which are acting together after a given TW. This length, then, is the typical size of this number, say, for being simple, the cubic root of the number. For a given field, I can say to I can say how many spins are coupling to this field through this barrier reduction, which is seen in the data as a shift of the inflection point. Actually, this method is not new. This was developed in a collaboration with Ray Orbach a few years ago. You can find it in this paper. And we have just added new data to this in order to see whether this length behaves differently in the easing case. So those are the results, number of correlated spins as a function of this reduced variable. The old results, which mostly concern Heisenberg-like spin glasses, are all together. And you see that they can, well, in average, be fitted by this straight line, which corresponds, as a function of this variable, it corresponds to this power law, which is also found in numerical simulations. So all data were together, but now we have the results from the easing sample, these red points here, and they don't want to lie on the same line. They are they point out to slightly smaller values of this number of spins. Well, does it correspond to what we have seen already? I think that yes, because if I consider that these memory effects are made by imprinting different lengths as a function of decreasing temperature in the spin structure, then I need bigger structures to feel more ease, to put more memories in it. So that's a hand-waving argument, but I think this is in confirmation of the temperature cycle experiments. Of course, we can go a little bit further, yeah.
The simulation prediction is actually for the Ising model.
Yes.
Well, here you are fitting it to the Heisenberg.
That's right. Yes, I should have underlined it. Yes, you're right. So the agreement between simulations and experiments is not so good finally, because the easing data from the experiment don't fit very well to the... But okay, the time scales are so different between numerics and experiments.
What is the size of statistical errors on red points?
On the red points, it's something like this, maybe. So it's rather... Okay, yes, but why should there be the same description for all samples? I say that maybe it's better to try to go beyond, because we should be able to account not only for these results, but also for the temperature variation results. I mean, these...
But how not is just the microscopic time course in what single thing?
10 to the minus 12, we consider. Which, well, it should not vary by orders of magnitude. But indeed, our interpretation of this, which is here, I'm sorry, this is a little bit ugly, but I can tell you, we propose that if we want to account for all experimental results, we should consider that times and lengths are indeed related by some activation processes, but that this attempt time from the results, so here I have replotted the temperature variation experiment results, and you see that these easing results are really weakly sensitive to temperature changes. So this points out to longer times for this attempt time for thermal activation. So indeed, what we propose as an explanation is to consider that in the easing case, there is a strong influence of critical fluctuations which impose a renormalization of this attempt time. And on the other hand, this activated behavior in which there is a typical barrier, referring to temperature, this barrier can be written in the way that Fisher proposed in the droplet model. This is something like in a ferromagnet which vanishes at TC or TG and which is increasing when we go to lower temperatures. So in that case, I can reproduce the data in the isotropic spin glasses, which are very steepy here, which corresponds to a strongly superactivated behavior, superactivated in the sense that when I decrease temperature, the barrier is increasing in addition to this thermal slowing down. And on the other hand, on the easing side, we can consider that this does not play very much role, and the dynamics is dominated by critical fluctuations, which would not be very strongly temperature dependent. And so that's explanations by hand, but we have fitted the results to this kind of formula, which is not so different from the power law, which would be here. You see the power law, which would correspond to this effective exponent, which is now temperature and even length dependent. But that explains that we can obtain a good agreement with part of the results with this power law. But now that we have the easing results, which are clearly underactivated in some way, probably we have to think of something more general, like this this formula proposed by Bouchot. So what you see as lines here in these graphs are fits of the results to this formula with a given set of parameters for each of the samples. So that's a common description of a huge number of experiments, which are temperature variation experiments and field variation experiments. So that's why you may consider this black line does not fit very well to the to this black point here from silver manganese and here. But well, however, we tried to make a compromise in such a way that this picture can account for this and this. So of course there are several free parameters in this thing, so I don't pretend to be able to say something precise on each of the parameters, but what is interesting is to see for a plausible set of parameters how does time vary as a function of the corresponding length scale. And that's what I have plotted here. So we recommend these parameters as good fitting parameters, maybe not the only ones. If I take another set of good parameters, then I get similar curves here. Those curves are just summarizing all the story. They are obtained by inverting this relation and taking L cube, which is n, as a function at fixed time, as a function of temperature. And this is just this temperature microscope effect that we wanted to check in different samples. How, at a given waiting time, does the number of correlated spins vary with temperature? If it's varying very fast, this means that at one temperature, I can imprint the memory of aging at the scale of this number of spins. And then if I go to another lower temperature, I have a very different length scale, and I can imprint something else which will not interfere with aging at the higher temperature. And that's the kind of behavior that we obtain for one example of Heisenberg-like sample. This is a rather fast variation of this typical number with temperature, which emphasizes the temperature microscope effect. And on the other hand, the easing sample shows a behavior which is much weaker with temperature. This corresponds to these memory dips, which are more spread out in temperatures. The structures that are imprinted at different temperatures are not concerning such a different number of spins, and there is more interference between aging at different temperatures. So note that this psi exponent for the barrier exponent of the droplet-like picture is much smaller in the easing case than in the others, which corresponds to this behavior. And well, of course, I don't mean that the length which is involved by this psi exponent is the length of a compact droplet. It's the length of something which is to be precise. Yeah. Number of spins which could correlate to each other after a time TW at temperature T.
Somehow I would have thought you'd get smaller droplets at higher temperatures because you've got more fluctuations and things and less.
Smaller droplets at?
Higher temperatures, whereas you're getting bigger droplets.
Well, those are the bigger things you can construct in the spin glass after TW. It does not tell you what are the dominant small-scale excitations. It's this is extracted from aging.
Uh-huh.
So it's the most rigid part of the spin glass. Okay, I think it's been long. So let's get to the conclusions and a kind of summary of the story. The first part was about aging phenomena at constant temperature, which I showed you to be about the same in spin glasses, polymers, colloids, and other glasses. We can have rejuvenation under the effect of a magnetic field in the spin glass, which is, I think, comparable to the effect of a mechanical stress in glasses or colloids. Now, if we vary temperature, we find that the spin glasses are weakly sensitive to the cooling rate, and they show spectacular rejuvenation and memory effects as a function of temperature. These rejuvenation and memory effects are certainly possible in some polymers or dielectrics. And an important question is, how can this be generalized? Is aging a combination of cooling rate effects which accumulate aging in temperature with temperature specific effects, which would be the rejuvenation and memory effects? And if the answer is yes, well, we have some interesting comparison between glasses and spin glasses, which show same phenomenology with very different microscopic building blocks, and this is yet to be understood, I think. If we want to understand aging in terms of length scales, this hierarchy of metastable states should correspond to a hierarchy of active dynamical length scales in the spin glass. This power law has been obtained in simulation for easing models and for Heisenberg samples in real experiments. The results from the easing sample push us to go beyond this simple power law, and we propose that the general behavior is a crossover from a critical to a superactivated type dynamics. But of course, this question of length scales is a little bit speculative. I did not say what are these length scales. Maybe there can be information from numerics about that. And what are these domains? Are they sponge-like, as proposed by Martin, Krakala, and others? And our results show that a sharp memory effect may correspond to a strong separation with temperature of these active length scales in order to have independent aging evolutions. And we find that this temperature separation is stronger for Heisenberg spins than in the easing case. And I don't know what can be the explanation of this difference between easing and Heisenberg spin glass. I hope that there will be some progress in the future about this. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much indeed. We have time for just one or two questions.
You mentioned chaos. I mean, can you say a few more words about this, about the chaos?
Yes. So I showed an example in which this chaos, well, what chaos has been proposed to occur in these spin glasses by Bray and Moore and by Daniel Fisher as well. I think the argument is that the the field that a spin feels from its environment is the result of many cancellations, because the interactions are contradictory. And the idea is that if you make a very small change in temperatures, these cancellations may change in a random way, and that would make that the equilibrium state at a given temperature is different from the equilibrium state at another temperature in the spin glass case. I think that's more or less the idea of the chaos, and this is what is simulated, but it's done by hand here by changing the equilibrium state of this Matisse model. So this is able to produce rejuvenation, because then when you change temperature, the system wants to go to another equilibrium state, and there is obviously rejuvenation. But there is some problem with the memory, because you should not reshuffle everything in that case. And you should be able to preserve the memory while you are doing some rejuvenated new dissipation. So that's not easy. In that case, it could work, but the time scale at the in the second stage was much shorter than in the other stages. So I think that maybe we can escape this question of chaos by simply considering that there are so many configurations possible in such complex systems that at any given temperature there are a lot of configurations which need to be equilibrated, and others which are already equilibrated. And when we change temperature, we get to another set of configurations, and what was equilibrated at one temperature may fall out of equilibrium when we go to another temperature, simply because of the temperature variation of the corresponding Boltzmann weights. So that's Bouchot's idea, getting without chaos, in a few words. That could be like an elastic line in a pinning disorder. That's another story.